Good afternoon. It's 12:06 and time for Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOI 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I hope you join today's conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-471-9264. You can always post on our Midday Matters Facebook page or email us middaymatters@nipr.fm. In the studio with me, of course, is my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. Today we will be discussing pediatric ENT, ear, nose, and throat conditions and surgeries with Dr. Deep Reddy, pediatric ENT specialist and surgeon with ENT Associates. Welcome, Dr. Reddy.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Our topics today will include ventilation, ear tube placements, tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy, endoscopic sinus surgery, and surgical correction of congenital or neonatal neck and upper airway deformities. 7% of U.S. children have PE or pressure-equalizing ear tube placements by 3 years of age, with a total of upwards of 1 million tube procedures performed each year for chronic or recurrent ear infections and hearing loss. Up to 500,000 tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies in all age groups are performed in the United States yearly for chronic throat, ear, and sinus infections, and most importantly, upper airway obstruction causing sleep apnea. There are 1 billion, B-I-L-L-I-O-N, cases of acute sinusitis diagnosed in the United States per year in all age groups, with 10 to 20% of children affected having bacterial sinus infections. Recurrent sinus infections in children may require non-invasive endoscopic sinus surgery to correct the existing condition and prevent future sinus obstruction and infections. It must be kept in mind that ENT surgeries in children are not approached lightly and that surgical intervention is only considered after a complete diagnostic evaluation and multiple efforts of maximal medical therapy have been instituted and have failed to resolve the persistent ear sinus or upper airway obstruction and/or infection. Surgical intervention can quickly resolve the acute or chronic ENT condition and enhance the child's quality of life. If not adequately treated with appropriate maximal medical therapy and surgical care, these conditions can lead to severe medical emergencies in the short run and/or chronic disabilities in the long term. Dr. Reddy, tell us more about the role of the pediatric ENT specialist in dealing with these conditions, starting with PE tube placements.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say, Peter, is that there's we need to clarify that most ear, nose, and throat surgeons do perform PE tube placement and tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy. That's essentially the sine qua non of our profession. That's one of those things that we all do. The specific role of the pediatric otolaryngologist in that equation is frequently I'll see, or any one of my colleagues in my subspecialty will see, some of the more complicated cases that may require some more complicated approaches. But for the most part, the role of PE tube placement and tonsillectomy and such procedures is to treat a condition surgically that has thus far not responded to medical therapy. And in most cases, that medical therapy has been exhausted by the pediatrician, the family doctor, the primary care physician who has used antibiotics and other medical options, and they've essentially at that point make the decision to refer to us to see what more can be done.
And the underlying condition of recurrent otitis, chronic serous otitis, how frequently do we see this? Why do we see it so frequently in infants and small children? And what are the consequences of not placing these tubes?
You know, we see this, of course, very frequently. Ear infections, in particular otitis media, is the second most common ailment afflicting children, the most common being upper respiratory infection in general. It's the most common reason that parents take their children to the pediatrician. And the reason it occurs so frequently in children, otitis media in particular, is that the anatomy and physiology of their nasopharynx, the back of their throat, the little tube that connects the throat to the ear called the eustachian tube, that does not function well in small children, particularly under the age of three, because of the shape of the skull. skull base, the length and the dimension of that eustachian tube, the functionality of that tube in terms of opening and closing and assuring proper ventilation of the middle ear space, and frankly, their exposure to viruses at a very high rate, and to some extent, the relative immunodeficiency of children compared to adults. All of these things provide an optimal situation for viruses and bacteria to get into the middle ear space and to cause infection. The consequences of this are that they are frequently suffering from the symptoms of the infection and require multiple trips to the doctor.
And the underlying causes would be obstruction of the eustachian tube drainage caused by?
Obstruction of the eustachian tube ventilation and drainage, and usually that's caused by swelling in the back of the throat from the inflammation that viruses in particular will cause.
And it would be the adenoidal hypertrophy, and in many instances, up to 50% of kids with recurrent infection can have this, recurrent ear infections have it caused by underlying allergic congestion as well. So once all the medications and medical approaches have been exhausted, the PE tubes are, how are the PE tubes placed, and how traumatic is this or isn't it for the child?
Well, interestingly, the actual placement of PE tubes is a fairly straightforward procedure that actually could be performed in the office in adults and older teenagers who can actually tolerate the local numbing anesthetic. But the reason that it ends up being a surgical procedure requiring an anesthetic in younger children is that we cannot have them tolerate that procedure in the office. The procedure itself is performed under an operating microscope using microsurgical instruments to make a small incision in the eardrum, suction out any fluid that's behind the eardrum, and then place a very small, in most cases, a 1 to 1.4 millimeter diameter plastic tube that actually is retained within the eardrum for a variable amount of time, usually a few months up to a couple of years, providing a temporary ventilation for the middle ear space.
So with the ventilation, we not only have equal air pressure inside and outside of the middle ear, but you get the fluid out that had accumulated. And if that fluid was retained, the consequences are?
Absolutely. If fluid behind the eardrum, the space behind the eardrum is called the middle ear space. And that is actually a space that, although it communicates with the nasopharynx, the back of the throat, through that eustachian tube, it's usually a closed space. So any fluid in a closed space is a perfect milieu, perfect environment for bacterial proliferation. So fluid being in the middle ear space, if it is just quiescent fluid that's not infected, it will cause at minimum symptoms such as pressure and discomfort, and also can cause conductive hearing loss, meaning that the sounds that the eardrum picks up from the environment cannot be transmitted to the auditory nerve and then relayed to the brain appropriately. So it will cause some degree of hearing loss.
And we all know older members of our families who have hearing loss dating back to their childhood in the early part of the 20th century, when the fluid built up, remained, and then it becomes what we call a glue ear, and it prevents the vibration of the hearing ossicles, the bones, and they have permanent hearing loss. Thus, can be a consequence of not attending to chronic serous otitis or fluid behind the ear.
It can be, Peter, but fortunately, those cases are a little bit less common, and the more common development would be at least a temporary hearing loss until that fluid is removed. Thankfully, in most of the children, once we remove the fluid and that fluid stays away and the inflammation is resolved, when we do a postoperative follow-up hearing test in those children, most of them will have pretty normal hearing, or at least the hearing that they would have had. But there certainly can be long-term hearing loss. They can develop from anything from scarring of the ossicles to actually sensory neural hearing loss from some of the pathology extending up to the auditory nerve.
So your criteria for the surgery would be hearing loss and recurrent infections. What do they say? Three ear infections per 6 months or four per year? Will you have certain criteria for this?
Yeah, there are some hard and fast criteria that we can refer to and say, in general, if you're an otherwise healthy child, three infections in a six-month period or four infections or more in a year, occurring somewhat clustered in most cases, that will bring the child to us through referral. And if we see those minimum criteria met, it becomes a lot easier for us to at least convince whether parents and others that this is a procedure that would be beneficial. Another criterion would be chronic fluid that remains for 6 to 12 weeks without resolving and causing major symptoms such as pain, hearing loss, and other discomfort.
And we then, when we put the tubes in, we've seen very quick relief. The kids sleep better, they feel better, they act better. And we've seen instances with little children who weren't speaking because of the chronic fluid behind the ear obstructing their hearing mechanism, suddenly start speaking.
It's really amazing. It's one of the more gratifying procedures that we do because unlike many other surgical procedures, the recovery is almost instantaneous. With other procedures where you're making an incision in the skin, for example, it takes a couple of weeks for the incision to heal. You've got some pain. With ear tubes in particular, once you make that incision and drain the fluid, there's an instantaneous improvement in the hearing, and also there's minimal discomfort to the child. Really, they recover by later that day. They're up and around, usually doing their thing. And so it's really gratifying from that standpoint that the hearing loss that may be associated from chronic fluid is immediately relieved.
Wonderful. We touched earlier about the role of the adenoids, adenoidal hypertrophy, blocking up the ear tubes. What are the adenoids? Where are they? And what effect do they have on ear and sinus disease and obstructive sleep apnea?
Well, the adenoids are a major player in all sorts of diseases of the upper airway, including the ears and the nose and the throat. And what they are their lymphoid tissue, tissue containing cells associated with the immune system. And what they do is they initially filter viruses and bacteria and help to process them so that the body can create antibodies to those pathogens. They're located in a strategic location, strategically advantageous location where basically they're behind your nose and behind your palate. So every time we breathe in microbes, they pass right by that area. So in that sense, they're ideally located. The problem comes when they become colonized by bacteria and viruses, and then they become chronically infected or they become enlarged as a secondary reactive process to that exposure. Now you've got a situation where bacteria are multiplying and constantly present within this gland or this this collection of glands that's located very close to your eustachian tube, and therefore they can go right up into the ears and cause ear infections. It's also located right underneath the sphenoid sinus, which is your central most pair of sinuses in your skull base, but also behind your ethmoid sinuses, so they will definitely contribute to sinus infections. And then the adenoids are also associated with the tonsils and other lymphoid tissue within the back of the throat, which will collectively become infected. So when we talk about things like tonsillitis, what we're really talking about is a tonsillopharyngitis and adenoiditis, and that will cause sore throats, postnasal drip, and cough, sometimes mimicking sinusitis, sometimes causing sinusitis.
And even if the adenoid isn't grossly hypertrophy, just being a constant focus of infection, you've pointed out in meetings in the past that this can be a setup for recurrent sinus and ear infections too.
Absolutely.
That it's just holding infection.
As we like to say in our profession, size doesn't matter when it comes to the adenoids. And it matters when it comes to obstructive symptoms that the patient may be there to see you about. But in cases of infection, they do not have to be large in order to be causing this problem. Their simple presence is what actually is contributing to the problem.
And many years ago, tonsillectomies were performed mainly because of recurrent throat infections. But today, the tonsils and adenoids play a role in obstruction. And that is now the major justification of TNAs.
Absolutely. It used to be the case that approximately 90%, I think as of the early 70s, 90% of tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies were performed for recurring pharyngitis. Now about 80% of tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies are performed for obstructive sleep apnea or obstructive sleep disordered breathing. And that's a condition where because of the size of the adenoids and the tonsils, airflow is obstructed in a patient as they breathe in and when they breathe out. And that proliferation and that increase in size is related to these lymphoid tissues responding to viruses and bacteria and then not shrinking back down to their original size.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on 89.1 FM WBOY. And if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-471-9264. You can always post on our Midday Matters Facebook page or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We need to take a short break, but we'll be back with more of the program in just a few moments. This is 89.1 FM WBOY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jennifer Gilmore. Her new novel, The Mothers, is based on the experiences she and her husband had trying to adopt a baby. They gave up on international adoption and pursued open adoption in the U.S., but ran into all kinds of obstacles as well as a scam or two. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Talk of the Nation provides you with the day's news and more, the experiences and opinions of people around the country and around the world. I'm Jennifer Ludden. When you're looking for the latest news and how it affects you, your family, your neighbors, your life, turn to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold & Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Will your money last? With a retirement plan, it can. More information on Reinbold & Anderson on the web at reinboldandanderson.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY 89.1 FM. It is 12:24, and if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. We're talking about pediatric ENT, different issues and different procedures that your child may be qualified for or may need. And to do that, we have Dr. Deep Reddy, who is helping answer your questions and comments. If you give us a call at 1-800-471-9264, the phone lines are wide open. We would love to have your question or comment on the air. You can always post on our Midday Matters Facebook page or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah DeLeon, and in the studio with me is my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. Getting back to obstructive sleep apnea, it has been estimated that 2-5% of our children have obstructive sleep apnea, chiefly caused by tonsillar and adenoidal hypertrophy. Aside from the fact that this disrupts sleep, the kids have multiple awakenings during the night when they have long pauses in their breathing, their oxygen levels drop down. In adults, this can lead to heart failure and hypertension. But a recent finding has shown that up to 25% of kids with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, have really been misdiagnosed and actually have adenoidal and tonsillar hypertrophy causing sleep apnea, causing their ADHD. So we really have a major issue here that can be easily solved by the tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies. You do see a fair amount of these patients.
I do, Peter, and I think the most important thing that we have to do as clinicians is to do a good job of diagnosing a child properly as having sleep apnea in the first place. And it's seems fairly obvious when you see it in a grown adult, but in a child, you can see some more subtle signs that may point to it. For example, in an adult, most of us have seen or maybe nightly sleep next to someone who in my case, thankfully not, but someone who stops breathing in their sleep, they snore, and then they all of a sudden stop snoring, and then they start again with this horrible gasp, and it looks like they're just dying. In children, the signs can be like that as well, but more frequently, we'll see children who have snoring, to be sure, but they also then will have a lot of restless sleep. They will do a lot more of the windmill, just moving around in the bed. Their parents will come in saying that they're all over the place. They'll also have some other signs and symptoms such as sleepwalking, talking out or crying out in their sleep, bedwetting, teeth grinding, daytime somnolence, which is one of the more important consequences of this. And then sometimes, of course, down the road, some more of the subtle physiologic things such as heart enlargement and hypertension, things like that. But when children have this problem, it's particularly bothersome to them in the daytime because we see children who are hyperactive and we say, well, that's just a hyperactive child. They have ADHD. But children respond to a lack of quality sleep in ways that are different than adults do. If you or I were to have a bad night's sleep, we might put our head down on the desk and snooze for a little bit. What children will do is they'll get wound up and get hyperactive in many cases, and they will be ornery, they will be running through walls, and they'll be misdiagnosed in some cases as having ADHD. Most cases of ADHD are absolutely, and all of them to an extent are absolutely correctly diagnosed, but they may have a contributing factor from sleep apnea, and that's the important thing to recognize.
And we actually have a caller on the line, Stacy, who has a question about her 8-year-old snoring. So good segue. Stacy, welcome to Health 360 Midday Matters.
Yes, I do. My 8-year-old snores. I just noticed it recently. He's not hyperactive. Sometimes he falls asleep on the way home from school. And he does kind of sleep restlessly. So I guess I was wondering what I should do for him.
Well, I think the most important thing that I ask parents to do when they've come in to see me and we're maybe not so sure if a child has sleep apnea is to have the parents observe the child very closely when they're sleeping. These days, we, of course, still do sleep studies, but they're expensive and they take some time. And sometimes we have other symptoms that can actually really clinch the diagnosis. If you're able to watch your child sleep once they're actually asleep for about half an hour to an hour, you may notice some subtle signs of obstructive breathing. You may notice, aside from the snoring, you might notice him taking a little bit of a pause and then starting up again with a subtle snort or a deeper breath. You may notice that then a change in position during sleep right after that happens. You may notice just in general a very restless sleep pattern. And you may notice that the mouth is open when they breathe. That's another thing. So the major things we tell people to look for are snoring, mouth breathing, restless sleep, and observed apneas. And then you may also look and see if it seems as though they've gotten up in the middle of the night and gone to the bathroom and back without really being awake while they do it, or subtle things like that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, Stacy. And if you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-471-9264 is the number to call right now. Or you can email us middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters.
As you mentioned, mouth breathing can be a major sign of adenoidal hypertrophy, and where the adenoidal overgrowth has blocked the nasal passages. Orthodontists have pointed out through the years that they felt that the adenoidal hypertrophy can actually affect the dentition, causing the adenoidal facies, high arched palate, and even changes in the orthodonture. What is your feeling about that?
Yeah, one of the things that we see classically is called the adenoid facies, and that's a child who does seem to have a little bit of a smaller midface and a more prominent mouth and dentition area, so upper gums, lower gums, they've got their mouth open. And we do see long-term that can lead to a crossbite or abnormal development there with abnormal occlusion of the upper teeth over the lower teeth. And so that is definitely one of those consequences of obstructive breathing, particularly through the nose if the adenoids are enlarged. Sometimes when the tonsils are enlarged, you can also get an abnormal positioning, an abnormal breathing posture in a child to move air past those enlarged tonsils. So abnormal craniofacial growth is definitely a potential consequence of enlarged adenoids and tonsils.
So our message is, if you notice any of these signs and symptoms in your child, at least discuss it with your family doctor or pediatrician to consider any further referral. Moving on, we've talked about how the adenoids can block up the eustachian tubes and cause ear infections. They obviously can block up the sinus exits, as you mentioned earlier. Tell us more about sinus infections in children, chronic sinusitis, and the sequelae, the dangerous sequelae, if they're not treated adequately.
And, you know, sinus infections are one of those tricky things in kids because they can be mimicked by other conditions, such as allergies and viral upper respiratory infections that occur so commonly in children. But when a child has sinus infection now, they probably happen more frequently than they do in adults, but they're treated surgically far less frequently than they are in adults for various reasons. But the typical signs and symptoms of a sinus infection as opposed to a run-of-the-mill cold would be a more persistent course, first and foremost, more than 7 to 10 days of the runny nose, and then the development of the runny nose into a yellow-green color, more of the facial puffiness, sometimes puffiness of the eyes, more of the postnasal drip and cough. All of these lasting for more than your average, you know, 3 to 5 to 7 day symptoms. The consequences of, first of all, and these conditions are quite adequately treated in most cases, and sometimes treated very aggressively with antibiotics when the diagnosis is very strongly suspected. I think the primary care physicians do a great job of that. One of the consequences of not treating, let's say, a sinus infection that has been observed, you know, long enough, but in that time period, some things that can occur would be spread of the infection to surrounding tissues. Rare conditions, but things that can happen, such as spread of the infection into the orbit, the eye, spread of the infection into the tissues underneath your skin, causing a cellulitis, things like that.
And even mastoiditis and meningitis.
Meningitis can occur, definitely. And then, you know, the mastoiditis would be more related to more of a chronic ear infection that could be festering. But with your sinuses, meningitis can happen if there's a sinusitis affecting your frontal sinus and in some cases a sphenoid sinus.
Do we see, how often do we see sinus headaches in smaller children, or is it more sinus tenderness with palpation?
And maybe a little bit of a more of an age-related thing, but younger children don't really complain of headaches as much as they have the runny nose and the congestion and the postnasal drip and cough. Older children may complain of headaches like adults do. And then there's a difference between the acute sinusitis and the chronic sinusitis. So acute sinusitis is pretty much a condition that resolves after adequate treatment, and then it may recur time after time, but it does resolve. A chronic sinusitis is a sinusitis that has set up in the sinuses and then causes more subtle symptoms for several weeks to months. And that would be more of the congestion, maybe the cough, but without the overt green-yellow drainage and eye symptoms and things like that.
But with acute sinusitis, there may be fever, and mostly in kids it's viral, but the chronic sinusitis is more bacterial?
Correct. More of the time, what will happen is that viral illnesses will cause the initial setup for a bacterial infection. And then when that bacterial infection sets in, either due to bacterial resistance or a complete closure of the sinus openings that connect to your nasal passages, the bacteria are walled off like an abscess, much like a chronic ear infection, or much like an abscess anywhere else in the body, and they're just sitting there causing inflammation.
And fever may or may not be associated with sinus infections.
Correct.
As we touched earlier, again, obstruction of the upper airway by adenoidal hypertrophy or congestion in the tissues of the nose by allergies will block up the doorways to the sinuses, and then what happens?
That's right. The major underlying factor seems to be, in most cases, inflammation that causes swelling of your mucous membranes of your nose. The sinuses connect to your nasal passages through very small openings, and we would consider those openings to be, for example, like the windows of a house or the door of a room. They should be open for proper ventilation, and when they get closed, you have a closed room or a closed house that can get musty, that can get infiltrated with mold. In this case, it's the bacteria that are sitting now in a closed space, and they can essentially multiply unabated. So the underlying inflammation can be caused by a number of things. It can be caused by allergies, it can be caused by viruses, and it can be caused by acid reflux coming up into the back of the nose and throat from the stomach. Those are the most common causes. And of course, bacteria can be supplied from those adenoids. But the major pathologic process initially is a closure of those small openings into the where the sinuses communicate with your nose because by swelling of the mucous membranes.
And tell us more about mucociliary clearance. The sinuses apparently have a normal ability to cleanse themselves, but under these conditions, that's affected.
Yeah, mucociliary clearance is a process where if you were to look at your the mucous membranes of your nose under a microscope, you would see tiny little cells that are called hair cells. And those hair cells beat back and forth, and they sway, much like tall grass in a field. And what they're doing is they are moving mucus that your other glands in your nose and sinuses produce along a certain preordained pathway. And what that mucus blanket is doing is it's clearing the viruses and bacteria that are always in your nose or that you're always exposed to out. And they're basically clearing them out to the back of the nasal passages, and the mucus blanket goes down your back of your throat and you swallow them. So the sinuses have that same epithelium, we call it, that same mucous membrane lining that the nose, that the nasal passages have. It's just pretty much continuous with them. And that can be impaired, that whole process can be impaired by a number of things. First of all, illnesses themselves, inflammatory conditions like allergies and reflux and viral exposure can impair that process. The other thing can be things like irritants such as cigarette smoke and other toxic fumes and other agents that can hinder the functionality of those hair cells.
Right. And so the use of the surgical approach, in the old days they used to do the major facial operations, but now in the last 20 years plus, you've been doing the minimally invasive endoscopic sinus surgery where you're really taking advantage of the normal mucociliary clearance patterns. And what are you actually doing when you go in to do the endoscopic sinus surgery?
What we're doing is we're using a small telescope attached to a video camera and monitor to essentially blow up this tiny area into a large picture so we can see where we're going. And we go right to those areas where the natural openings are. And we're basically making them bigger. And we're making them bigger with fine instruments that do that. And what we're trying to do is create a situation where those openings don't close off so easily when inflammation occurs. Certainly, a child will or an adult will continue to get colds. They will continue to have swelling in their nose from allergies. They may continue to get acid reflux. Those things are all going to happen. Inflammation of the nasal mucous membranes is going to happen, but we don't want those. We want to keep those doors open. We want to keep those little openings open so that we can have proper ventilation of the sinuses.
We need to take a quick break for the news here on Health 360 Midday Matters, but we'll be back in just a few moments. We have a question from the web that we're going to get to when we're back in just about 4 minutes. If you have a question that you'd like to get on the air, 1-800-471-9264 is the number to call. You can always write in at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post right on our Facebook page, Midday Matters. It's 12:38 and we'll be back in just a few moments here on 89.1 FM WBOY.
George Plimpton played for the Detroit Lions, then the New York Philharmonic.
A lot of people think I'm some sort of a crazy buffoon who can't quite make up his mind what he wants to do in life.
He found his calling in participatory journalism.
I'm a professional writer and have this device of trying other people's professions.
Plimpton, a new documentary, later on All Things Considered from NPR News. This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. Indiana's Bureau of Motor Vehicles is responding to a class action lawsuit saying it may have inadvertently overcharged Indiana drivers for their licenses. Indianapolis lawyer Irwin Levin filed a suit earlier this year, alleging the state collected up to $30 million more than it should have by charging drivers more for licenses than allowed by law. Lawyers for the state wrote in a May 15th court filing that the BMV is still trying to determine whether drivers were systematically charged more for their licenses. The lawsuit alleges drivers were charged up to $7 more for each license than allowed by law. Levin is seeking to have that money returned to drivers. State Attorney General Greg Zeller says Indiana will likely play a leading role in a U.S. Supreme Court case involving government prayer. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, it's not the first time Indiana has dealt with the issue in court.
In 2005, a U.S. District Court ruled the Indiana General Assembly's practice of praying before each session was unconstitutional. A circuit court later reversed the ruling, saying those who challenged the state's practice did not have legal standing to do so. It did not weigh in on the question of constitutionality, which is one reason Attorney General Greg Zeller says his office wrote a legal brief encouraging the U.S. Supreme Court to consider a case in which a New York town's use of prayer before board meetings is being challenged. Zeller says the case could affect larger legal issues.
Really, have we used the establishment defense, saying that we shouldn't try to establish a state sanctioned religion, to limit people's free exercise?
Reba Boyd Wooden is the Indiana Executive Director for the atheist organization Center for Inquiry. She says the General Assembly's daily prayer before each session marginalizes those who don't practice religion.
The religious people seem to think that when you try to grant any kind of respect or equality to people of other religions than their own, or particularly people who have no religion, that it's infringing on their religious freedom, and that's not true.
Zeller says because Indiana has been involved in a court case surrounding government prayer before, his office will play a major role in leading a group of states in a brief to the Supreme Court. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And state health officials are urging people to be careful as they head for Indiana's lakes and other bodies of water for summer recreation. The Indiana State Department of Health this week issued a list of health warnings for swimmers and others as Memorial Day weekend kicks off the summer swimming season. Every year, thousands of Americans get sick from germs or injured in places where they swim. In Indiana, there were 62 deaths from drowning or submersion in 2010. And let's take a quick look at the WBOY weather forecast on this Wednesday. Today, showers and thunderstorms likely, mostly cloudy skies throughout the day with a high near 80. Overnight chance of showers, mostly cloudy, a low around 58. And showers continue into Thursday. We'll have cloudy skies with a high near 62. You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 here on 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOI. It's 1243. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Deep Reddy, he is a pediatric ENT specialist and surgeon, and he's in the studio for the whole hour of today's program helping answer your questions or comments. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-471-9264. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us at middaymatters@nipr.fm. And we actually did get a write-in question. A woman wants to know, how do you tell the difference between allergies and a sinus infection? And what is the youngest that seasonal allergies usually appear in a child?
Right. So that is a great difficulty that a lot of people have, including clinicians like us, in telling what exactly is going on. And I think the main difference between allergies and sinus infection would be to look for signs that your child is actually looks kind of sick as opposed to just stuffy or runny nose. So signs of true illness would be fevers, more of a rundown appearance, and maybe the color or the quality of the mucus that's coming out of their nose. If you've got a sinusitis, it tends to be thick, green, yellow. Sometimes it's not hard to tell. I mean, sometimes not easy to tell the color. They may have some fever. They may be just run down. They may have more of the cough. Now, with allergies, you will have nasal congestion and cough. You will have runny nose that can be a thick white color or a clear color. And so it is definitely sometimes difficult to tell. But those would be the main factors. And then as far as the youngest that we see seasonal allergies, typically about 3 or 4 years of age, because it does take some time for a child to develop allergies to seasonal allergens. It may take 3 or 4 seasons, per se. You certainly do see perennial allergies, you see allergy symptoms in children younger than that.
Yes, the perennial allergies can start the first year with dust, mites, dogs, cats in the home, but the seasonal do take several years of exposure. Also, keep in mind with allergies, if your child has itchy, sneezy, watery, runny symptoms of the nose and eyes, but the drainage is basically clear and the child is otherwise pretty normal, it's probably allergies. But that same child with allergic congestion can definitely quickly go into sinus and ear infections. And we'll often see sinus infections occur seasonally because of the particular time of year that the child is reacting to the seasonal pollens or molds will cause the congestion that then blocks up the sinus doorways and the ear doorways, and we're often running with sinus infections. In the surgical procedure, how traumatic or how difficult is it for the children? This seems to be a pretty benign surgery, and how do you experience this?
Well, all things considered, it's interesting that our children who undergo endoscopic sinus surgery tend to recover better and with fewer severe symptoms than they have with other procedures that we do. In particular, everyone knows about how bad it feels to get your tonsils out, but sinus surgery ends up being a fairly milder recovery. They tolerate it well. The most common symptoms afterwards are some stuffiness and a little bit of soreness in the nose. In general, they recover a lot better than adults undergoing the same procedure.
And they're awake while you're doing it, but you numb the nasal tissues when you're putting in your scope?
No, actually, our procedure is done entirely under general anesthesia.
In little?
In children. Go so, and in fact, even in most adults, it is actually an operative procedure under general anesthesia. And the reason for that is we need things to be absolutely stock still in that small little space when we're operating. But we do place decongestants to decongest the mucous membranes, allow us to better visualize the anatomy. And we do, as you mentioned earlier, do what we consider to be minimally invasive surgery. So what we're trying to do is to do as little as we can to create the greatest effect. So because we're operating in a relatively small space. So we're fairly conservative in what we do, removing any diseased tissues and opening up the sinus openings to create maximal ventilation.
Great. And the as we mentioned earlier, we look for allergies, underlying conditions, adenoidal hypertrophy, and In terms of obviously immunodeficiency, but then we get into cystic fibrosis and immodal cilia syndrome. Can you mention how important your approach and surgical approach is for those types of patients?
Yeah, I think one of the things, of course, that's important to note is that by the time you get to the point where you're needing a surgical procedure, you've usually exhausted medical therapy, and the majority of people who do end up getting sinus infections actually are normal people otherwise, but there are certain children who have cystic fibrosis and certain syndromes where those cilia, those hair cells that I mentioned earlier, don't work properly, and sometimes children will have an actual immunodeficiency syndrome where they don't have properly functioning white blood cells and such things, and by definition, they're going to have more infections of all types, but particularly of the upper respiratory tract. Rhinitis, sinusitis, ear infections. And so in those children, the approach to treating them once they get to us is a little bit more accelerated. They've already had the medical therapy. You know, we can try some more maximal therapy, including antibiotics, decongestants, and such things, but they're more of the surgical cases because they are actually, their immune system is not capable of fending off the chronic disease process. So we have to go in and clear the abnormal mucus, the abnormal secretions that they create by definition. We're there to go in there and make bigger openings so that we can maximize the ventilation of their sinuses. Anything we can do to allow the abnormal mucus to at least have less of a chance of building up and more of a way of draining.
And younger children with cystic fibrosis develop nasal polyps, and of course, older people with aspirin sensitive, you can have nasal polyps. Polyps play a role here with sinus infections too, in those in those individuals.
Yes, and polyps are a development from basically the inflammatory process that starts everything off. They're semi-solid masses that develop from the swelling of the mucous membranes. And then what they do is they occlude the sinus openings, and then they become the primary problem where they are actually blocking literally the opening of the sinuses. So when we go in to do a sinus procedure, frequently we know ahead of time that we're dealing with polyps, and we'll go in with a plan to remove them. And once they're removed, then it's just like removing any obstruction. You are improving ventilation.
Great. Now, one of the other roles of the ear, nose, and throat surgeon and in the pediatric realm would be congenital or neonatal newborn issues. Could you tell us about the congenital deformities and masses that you encounter that you are often called upon to operate on, often in a newborn?
Interestingly, there are some conditions that we know about even before birth, things that are diagnosed on ultrasounds, such as teratomas and things like that, large cystic hygromas, which are large cysts in the head and neck. They can occur in other parts of the body. But most often what will happen is a child will come to us at anywhere from a few weeks old to a few years old, and they've had the little lump in their neck, either on the side or in the middle or behind their ear or something like that, where it has either slowly grown or just been noticed for the first time. And we then have to differentiate what type of a mass that may be. Fortunately, they are very rarely malignant, although children do have their share of malignancies of the head and neck. But usually they're benign cysts, which are collections of fluid that are left over from abnormal development of the head and neck structures. So there are cysts like thyroglossal duct cysts, which are cysts that form in the tract that's left behind during development when your thyroid gland drops into the lower part of your neck from the back of your tongue. That's an embryonic process, and sometimes that's just somewhat of a process that's left behind, and we have to go in and remove the cyst because it keeps filling up with fluid and sometimes getting infected. Other types of cysts, congenital means you're born with it, so branchial cleft cysts, again, similar phenomenon but in a different location of the neck. These are internal structures, subcutaneous, but then they have tracts that extend to various locations, origin points, so to speak, within the neck. And then we have to trace out the entire tract so that it doesn't recur once we remove it. So those are congenital head and neck mass type problems. Then there are other congenital problems, meaning the things that children are born with, such as abnormal craniofacial development, abnormal shape of the face and skull bones, and development of critical structures. That we sometimes abnormalities of the airway that they're born with, that we have to go and do operations to correct.
So there are tracheal webs, but in a previous show, we talked about human papillomavirus, which apparently the baby can get the human papillomavirus from the mother, the HPV, and get papillomas in the trachea?
Yes, and this is a devastating problem that does occur through transmission through the birth canal, even when there is no known papilloma in the cervix or uterus of the mother. And those papillomas are basically warts, and they are diagnosed. Usually it's a child who is at either several weeks or beyond. Sometimes I've seen them as late as even a year or two old, where they come in and the presentation has been either an increasing stridor or noisy breathing or hoarseness. And we will perform a flexible laryngoscopy, which is a flexible fiber optic scope exam of the larynx, and find a wart-like or polyp-like mass on the vocal cords or elsewhere in the voice box, the larynx, that is fairly diagnostic. It's fairly obvious, and then we will have to go in and perform a laser ablation of that mass.
Wow. Through the years, there's been questions as to whether tonsillectomies, adenoidectomies were overperformed or overused, and my feeling, as we've talked today, is that if it's a last ditch effort after you've tried all maximal full medical therapy, what is your position and the position of the American Otological Society on this topic?
I think the most important thing to consider from our standpoint is, and of course from the general public standpoint, is that there's a certain pathway that's been established as far as where patients go when they've got certain symptoms and at what point do we decide what the proper therapy is. And fortunately, in our community here, we have an excellent pathway that's well established, where a patient, in this case a child, will be taken by their parent to their primary their pediatrician, family doctor, with something that has some problem, whether it's recurring tonsillitis or obstructive breathing, and then that primary care provider will either treat that condition any number of times before they then realize that maybe this is a problem that would require a tonsillectomy, or at least may warrant consideration of a tonsillectomy, and then they send that child to one of us as ENTs. And we'd like to think that every time we see someone, or every time we recommend that a tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy be performed, that we're making the right decision first and foremost, we are always making that decision on an individual basis. So the child sitting before me on any given visit, I'm trying to figure out what's best for that child. And what we have to do sometimes is use criteria. And some of those criteria are a little bit shady. There have been criteria that were developed decades ago by a pediatrician named Paradise. And the Paradise criteria are the ones that you might have heard of, where they stated that you had to have 7 or more strep throats in a year, 5 or more strep throats a year for 2 years, or 3 strep throats a year for 3 years. And those are fairly stringent criteria. Usually, of course, we don't see patients who have met those criteria, but they're pretty close. Or they have some other exacerbating factor, where we say, well, they have, you know, pretty close to that, or maybe they're halfway there, but they've got some other factor. Maybe they've had a peritonsillar abscess. Maybe they've been hospitalized for one of these episodes. Maybe they've had some airway issues because of one of these episodes. Any number of factors can lead us to determine that a child needs a tonsillectomy based on the extenuating circumstances, or because in our minds and between us and the parents, we make the decision that this child has suffered enough.
And the obstructive sleep apnea is the big one.
And
that's
almost exactly, and that is an absolute indication. So there are some indications for surgery that are absolute indications. If a child has sleep apnea and they have any evidence of enlarged tonsils and or adenoids, it becomes a pretty easily and justifiable decision to take those tonsils and adenoids out. If a child has chronically recurring sore throats, we do have to distinguish between bacterial tonsillitis and viral illnesses, although recurring viral tonsillitis can also be basically anything that's causing recurrent illness in the child can be an indication for a surgical approach.
We have just about 2 minutes left in today's program, so we want to give you a chance to leave you with any final words that you have, as well as a way for people to get in contact with your office if they're interested in making an appointment.
Sure. I think that I'd like to explain, or at least express my feeling that as a what we do is, as ear, nose, and throat specialists, is a little bit more than just the ear, nose, and throat. It also includes the neck and the sinuses and the airway and some other things. But we do consider ourselves to be tertiary care subspecialists, meaning that if you have a problem with your child, the pathway that's established is that you take your child or yourself as a patient to your primary care physician, to your pediatrician, your family doctor, and you and they will evaluate you for those problems. And then at some point, they will be the person who determines if you need an ear, nose, and throat specialist's evaluation. Obviously, some people have pathways where they can make an appointment directly with an ear, nose, and throat specialist. And if you are able to do that, the website that we have is www.entfw.com, entfortwayne.com. And they do have a login and registration page there in terms of things like creating an account and giving your information for, let's say, you want to set up a visit, putting in your information, your health questionnaire sort of mm-hmm. questions, so that you don't have to come into the office and fill out that kind of information on paperwork in the office. Our office phone number is 260-426-8117. And that's a fairly accessible
way. That's the way to get in touch with you. Well, mm-hmm. thank you so much for being a part of today's show.
Thank you for having me on the show, and thank you, Peter.
And with, as an allergist through the years, our long association with Dr. Reddy and his group, they work very closely with the primary care physician and the pediatrician, so your child will be getting total care, and all physicians will be communicating and working together to enhance the quality of life of your child who suffers from ENT conditions.
This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 and HD Channel 1 and streaming online at nipr.fm. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next. Thanks very much for listening, and have a great rest of your day.